futurebased.org.
Hi, and welcome everyone to the Future-Based X Inverse Surveillance AI podcast series. My name is Abdurrahman Hassan. I am the host of this series. I'm a data science practitioner and educator, particularly interested in the intersection between technology and critical theory. Inverse Surveillance AI is a project of the Asimov Institute, funded by the SIDN Fund. The project is a think tank of scientists, policymakers, and philosophers gathered to answer the question, how can we use AI as a panopticon to promote beneficial actions for citizens by organization? Based on the insights produced from this think tank, a first proof of concept will be developed in a hackathon. The project lasts around 6 months and operates from a utopian and solution-oriented approach. The main goal is to deepen the subject of inverse surveillance, meanwhile sharing all the information so that it can function as a launchpad for future research. We have already invited three guests to this podcast, where we discussed the philosophy behind inverse surveillance. We browsed through the various conceptualizations of the topic and talked about how laws can become a driving force in its implementation. Before we jump to our fourth guest, I want to reintroduce Stefan Leinen, professor of the Artificial Intelligence Research Group at the WU University of Applied Sciences at Utrecht and the director of the Asimov Institute. Welcome, Stefan.
Thank you, Abdul. Good to be here again.
Today, we want to dive even deeper onto what inverse surveillance might look like. The right man for this is Rudy van Belkom, who is joining us today. Rudy is currently a future researcher at the STT, where he is researching the future of democracy. He's an AI researcher with research spanning multiple publications and with a game exploring ethical design in AI. He has previously explored the interplay between trust and acceptance of radical technological innovation. Really happy to have you here.
Well, thank you, Abdo. Well, you said future researcher, and it's maybe a semantic discussion, but it's a futures researcher because there's not one future. So I can't research into the future because I have no idea what the future would look like.
Definitely. And I hope we'll be constructing one of these futures together today. And I'm particularly really, really excited to talk to you about inverse surveillance. So far from the discussions we've had, it seems really abstract. Without the right lingo or principles we can use to make it materialize, we want to envision together a surveillance society, that is, when the process of surveillance is subverted and the watching happens from below rather than from above. First, I'd like to ask you, as a speculative exercise, how the system might look like. It would be data heavy. It would entail a data heavy flow where citizens, governments, platforms, and users are both collecting information on each other. What does responsibility look like in such a system?
It's a good question, and it's a complex question at the same time, because we have a tendency when we look at responsible AI or responsible systems to talk about really abstract terms like, okay, we need privacy and we need transparency and it needs to be fair. But I think the discussion most of the times leads to these abstract guidelines or checklists, but we don't really know how to make them measurable. For example, transparency, I think inverse surveillance has a lot to do with transparency. But how transparent is enough? I mean, is it like 60% or 70%? Can you even talk about 70% transparent? What that does it mean? So how can we make sure we make those different kind of principles measurable? I think that's our biggest challenge. And one of the big things, I guess, that instead of looking at it as a linear process, it's also about making sure that we can weigh different values in relation to each other. Because in practice, we always have some kind of trade-offs, technical trade-offs. So if we want a really accurate system, the question is, how explainable is it? And if we want a real transparent system, the question is, how can we relate this to privacy? But there are also social trade-offs. So for example, what we think is important depends on the context, depends on culture, depends on, well, the target group you're asking. Because when we talk about inverse surveillance, I think it's a perspective from people who want to have this type of surveillance. And we also need to think about the people who don't want this or are not really capable of surveilling and using technology for it. So another point is inclusivity. And I think that's also a part of the discussion today.
No, I think that's really wonderful. First of all, shifting our linear, straightforward path towards what we think is fair or just towards something that is more evolving, emergent, iterative. And the second thing that you mentioned was about trade-offs. There are some tensions and we have to pick sometimes sides. We have to be a little biased in which direction we should take. And one of these trade-offs we discussed earlier was transparency and exposure, right? So when people are watched, when people are in front of a camera or a surveillance system, doesn't matter which side you're on, your behavior changes. So I wanted to ask you about this trade-off between being transparent. You said it's kind of a scale, 70% transparent, and exposure. When it comes to inverse surveillance, how can we conceptualize both things? This is something you referred to earlier as the chilling effects of inverse surveillance. How can we counteract those effects?
I think it's important when we talk about trade-offs, it's not like one or the other. I mean, there are tensions between them. And when it comes to transparency, when people are being watched, like you said, there are some kind of chilling effects. So for example, if I don't like a certain type of policy that the government created in a democracy, I could use my right to protest. But if I know that when I'm going out to protest, there are surveillance cameras there, first of all, I'm not sure if I make the decision to go and protest. But if I do make the decision to go out, maybe I'm not acting the same as when the cameras are not there. And I think when you inverse surveillance, the same effect will happen. And I think the way we use our political systems and the way it's orchestrated, it's more or less a popularity game. Politicians in this case obviously use some kind of marketing slogans and tools, etc., to make themselves popular. If you keep it in the metaphor of a camera, when the camera is on, well, they change their behavior. And I think if people are being watched, I'm not sure if they are focusing on being transparent and being open and being fair, but they're more or less being focused on how do I come over in front of people and how will this affect the voting of people. And so the chilling effects that are acquainted with surveillance, I think we also need to think about them when you inverse it, because...
Yeah, so what I like about your explanation of the chilling effect, really, is that while you're fleshing this out, it shows that these values that we're talking about, privacy, transparency, they are not symmetric in the sense that they all play different roles in this decision-making system. So maybe looking at surveillance, whether it's top-down or bottom-up, we could sort of see a model appear where it's always about who or what body is making decisions based on what information. And I think if we look at, let's take a democratic system, our ideal would be that the decisions made by the governing bodies are in balance, whatever that may mean, are in balance in some way with the decisions made at the individual level. And if there's an imbalance in information, there's always a risk of an imbalance of decision-making. And then I'm reminded of Sartre, who said, le faire, c'est l'autre. And one way to explain his existential dread is the idea that if the others are making decisions for you, then you don't have any freedom left. So to what extent can you make your own decisions? And I think the way you just described the chilling effect shows that if you take this too far and you have cameras watching protesters, for example, and then it takes away the possibility of these decisions in a way by providing you the information that you're being watched. And so the question is, what mechanisms, what futures perhaps, can we come up with to construct a chilling effect in the reverse? In other words, perhaps restore the balance or push the balance to the other side, where decisions made by organizations or governing bodies are being constrained by the information provided to them by citizens. And that's an open-ended question, of course, but I think that's what we're trying to explore.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that's the thing with chilling effects. If you have information that you are being watched, whether you are or not being watched, in practice, it leaves its mark. It could help to look at inverse surveillance as a form of participation. At the moment, I'm doing research on the impact of technology on the future of democracy. And when it comes to democracy, I mean, the Greek word says it, it's demos kratos, it's about power of people. And I think inverse surveillance is a form of power and is a form of participation. And when we look at participation, there is one thing we need to take a look at, because it's called the participation paradox. So it means that if we add possibilities for people to participate, you would suggest that it gets fairer. But most of the time, there's this participation elite. So it's a small group of people who are most involved in politics or in other kind of policy making. So the people who are not particularly involved get less saying, because this small group of people who has a strong voice has more possibility to make their point. So when it comes to participation as a concept or like a construct, maybe inverse surveillance is a form of digital activism. And there are a lot of theories and also practical theories about it. And when you look at the pyramid of digital activism, you could say there are three levels of participation. So at the lower level, and it's not really a hierarchy or of like better or worse or stuff like that, but at the lower platform, you could say that we have spectator activities. So for example, what's called clicktivism, it's for people who do want to participate, but not really in a really intense way. And for example, if you sign a digital petition or something, you could just click and show your support. Or a bit further, political consumerism, for example, like Kickstarter, that you could back a project and say, okay, I'm willing to invest in this social cause. And by investing, even if it's a small amount, you could actually make this kind of impact. And at a higher level, you could say it's more like hacktivism. So I saw this interesting project where designers created a bot or different bots, and they send out their bots on the internet, and they were trained to spot news about climate change. So every time they looked at this climate change news article, the bot automatically pressed the button for the ad that shown. So every time these different bots clicked on the different ads, obviously the article got more worth in a way and got higher in Google, got higher in the ranks, etc., etc., etc. It's a friendly way of hacking into the system. When we relate this to inverse surveillance, you could also create a system where there are different levels of participation. So for people who are like, okay, I want to know something and I want to show that I'm here, I can show my support, or the other way, I can just click and say, okay, this is it. But there are also people who are like, okay, but I want more involvement. So that should also be possible, I guess. So if you could maybe even create your own little project on the surveillance platform and make sure other people join your cause, then you could also get more involvement. And maybe even for the people who are really invested, they could have more possibilities.
Definitely. I think this adds a lot of nuance to the conversation about inverse surveillance. Because in the beginning, you talked about that surveillance or counter-surveillance or inverse surveillance, they accentuate a performance. There's a performative aspect of being watched. You also mentioned that it exposes certain inequalities, right? So if all the information is exposed about minorities, about certain disabled groups or protected groups, how do we make sure that in this kind of free-for-all where information flows are going back and forth, fully exposed, how do we protect these people? And then we talked about participation. What are the different levels? Not everyone is participating in the system with the same affordances and so on. It seems to me, and maybe I'm projecting at the moment, that there is an issue of trust within the system. How do we trust the information flows? How do we trust the process of surveilling? How do we trust that the information is going to be used properly, that there's not going to be negative exposure? And you've alluded to the fact that people have been using AI, right, or certain technologies to govern these systems or to interact with these systems, just like the hacktivism. There is two projects that come to mind, the Dries Poorter project, looking at the parliament members, I think it was in Belgium. Yeah. That was one project. And then there is a couple of other projects as well, where people try to go into platforms and try to decipher the algorithms, to try to watch how these algorithms work. So how can AI and digital technology help us figure out a way to make the systems responsible?
You talked about the project of the Belgian project. It's an interesting form of surveillance where government members were being watched and the system was trained to recognize when people were using their smartphone. So in other words, when people weren't paying attention. And I think this is more or less more like an art project. I think this opens up a discussion. What do we need to know of these different government officials or from top companies like Facebook or Google, etc.? What do we need to know? What do we need to know to the system or the company or the government becomes trustworthy? And I think that's a pretty difficult question, because 100% transparency isn't, or probably isn't, the way to go, because I don't think 100% transparency leads to more trust. And the discussion is interesting because you can look at from different perspectives to trust. I mean, trust is something you should gain or you should win. And the discussion most of the times is about how can we make it trustworthy instead of how can we be trusted? I don't really have an answer for that because it depends on the context. Well, let's compare with a car. I have no clue what happens in an engine of a car. I do have my driver's license. I know how to operate a car, but when you ask me to look under the hood, I have absolutely no idea. A friend of mine also has a driver's license, but he knows everything that's going on. Maybe it's about interest. Maybe it's about he needs to know in order to trust this mechanism or this machine. And I think it depends who you ask. So some people are like, I don't really care. I just need to know how to drive. Other people are like, okay, I need to know, is it tested? Is it safe? How does the machine operate, et cetera, et cetera. So when it comes to inverse surveillance, we also need to ask, okay, in comparison with a car, do we need to know what goes on beneath the hood? Or do we need it to be explainable? Do we need to know that certain decisions are being made? This is explainable for me. It's a different thing than transparent.
We can do the same exercise without technology or AI, right? And there you would say, what is the decision to be made? Decision is, let's say, to make a vote. And then we gather information in order to make that an informed decision. The media, for instance, can play a role with that, or discussions with our peers. But we can also look for other ways. What other decisions can be made by individuals? And what information is necessary to make those decisions? For example, let's say in the capitalist narrative, we make decisions all the time by buying goods or buying services. And we gather information to make those decisions. But there's many more decisions we make every day. And some of those decisions affect the way that organizations act. So I think a question that comes out of this is, what other decisions do we make during the day that influence this balance between the individual and the organization? And then how can AI play a role in informing those decisions?
True. I first want to react to the question asked before, how can AI contribute? And I think one of the benefits is that it allows us in a way to have more control over inequality when it comes to gender or race, etc. I mean, most of the times, in a way, we seem to forget that human beings, we aren't neutral. So, we could use technology to manage the different conditions that create biases or exclusivity nowadays. So I think, yes, in researching and gathering information, AI could be helpful, but also it could play a role in making it more equal and making it more fair. AI may not be able to solve our mistakes entirely, but it can distribute them more fairly. So I think also maybe we need to just accept that the world isn't fair completely, because how does a complete fair and equal world look like? I mean, a fair world isn't always a just world, but I think AI could help balance out the human errors in a way. So we can make sure that the data sets we're using are, and that different groups are being involved.
I think that's wonderful, because one thing that really strikes me about this, and you mentioned that we need to balance out power structures. So at the end of the day, the whole exercise in inverse surveillance is supposed to give me a chance to hold someone who's a little bit more powerful accountable for what they did. So an exercise I think that we can take out of this is that, let's say I'm a citizen. I want to be informed about government practices. I think my government has too much information on me. I don't have enough on them to keep them accountable. And I don't want to know everything about my government. I don't want full exposure or full transparency. I just want to know key pieces of information that I can make more informed decision. And through the daily actions that Stefan has talked about, hold them accountable. Maybe the role of the kind of participation elite or the hackers is to expose tools to me like that help me make these better informed decisions. And that maybe is a form of inverse surveillance. And I think I want to go further down that exercise, because you said there are levels of participation, but I envision also different roles. Not everyone is just either watching or being watched. Maybe there are different roles in this kind of surveillance system or inverse surveillance system. So what other roles can we envision?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess we talked about, I think there are different levels of participation. That also means different roles. I think it's good to be aware of the fact that even if you're a spectator, you're still participating. And most of the times when it comes to participation or involvement, it's a bit of a traditional way of looking at it. So if you don't run for office or something, you're not really being involved. You also need to participate and be a member of a political party, go to rallies, and you should, flyer and everything. But I think when we look at the different roles, maybe we should also look at how teenagers, kids, young people these days use the internet because they cultivate technology in a completely different way. So for example, I have two little nieces. The oldest is 12 now, so she went to high school for the first time. And she's on TikTok all the time. And for me, it's like the silly dances and the silly movements. I don't really understand it. But there's also a lot of political information on TikTok. They're even more or less campaigning, debating, running fact checks and forming party-based coalitions, which they call hype houses, I was told. I read an interview about it with some young folks, and one of them called it cable news for young people. So they don't trust the regular traditional channels. They create their own fact-checked niche communities where they can find like-minded people, etc. So it's a real boomer, okay, boomer thing to say, okay, social media is toxic and the internet is making them depressed and stuff like that. And yes, it's a big problem. We need to take a look at that. But at the same time, I saw this research and they asked teenagers why they use social media. And one of the biggest answers was to interact with people from different backgrounds. So they are aware of the fact that there are filter bubbles and the echo chambers, but they also are online to find different people, to find different points of view. And when you talk about fake news, we are always like, okay, we need to make sure that children are critical. But I think they're more critical than a lot of adults these days. In the same research, it showed that one of the less chosen answers was find trustworthy information online. They are aware of the fact that information online isn't always trustworthy. And when you look at the different protests, the climate march, the Black Lives Matter movement, a lot of young people are being really engaged in society. Maybe they don't vote or they don't become a member of a political party, but they show their participation and activism in a completely different way. So maybe the question is, how can we integrate this flourishing form of activism in the traditional political system instead of how can we create a political system and make sure young people are interested in it? It's the other way around.
So rather than trying to mobilize people to care about these decisions we would like them to make, let's say a political decision, we can also take the bottom-up approach and see how people are mobilizing themselves and how can they be empowered. So, for instance, these, let's say, TikTok communities you describe and I don't understand, what decision power do they have? They have decision power, of course, within the group, within their peers. So in that sense, there's room for self-expression. I don't think there's much room for decisions that affect the way we organize ourselves or decisions that impact the way our society is organized, the system that we live under. So there seems almost like a cut where people can mobilize themselves and express themselves and be free to make choices. But the effects of those choices, the impact of it, almost like it doesn't reach a level where it can impact society. What opportunities are there to open up for impact and to allow these sort of mobilizing forces to actually change something radical?
I also think it has a lot to do with framing. So I did the technology key size, it's like this voting tool. And in a way, it's inverse surveillance. The reason I created this voting assistant is that when it comes to technology, digital technology, topics like privacy, fake news, mass surveillance, etc., a lot of political parties don't have a party program. They don't have a policy on these different kind of topics. So I actually forced the different political parties in the Netherlands to express themselves on these different topics, even if they don't have anything in their party program. It's a way of exposing a few of different parties. But when it comes to people who use them, 30,000 Dutch people who use this voting tool and oriented on which party they should choose in relation to their technology and digital technology policy. And I also used like a traditional frame in the question. So for example, I ask questions about citizen involvement. When it comes to citizen involvement, a lot of people don't feel the need to participate. So I imagine that citizen participation would be a big thing, especially among citizens. But when I ask them using this voting system, when it comes to, for example, a direct democracy, it's not really that popular. This traditional frame of participation has a tendency to be interpreted like, okay, it's hard, it's complex, it asks a lot of time. I need to have a lot of knowledge to participate. I need to, you know, find the right tools. So I also think when we communicate differently about what participation is, or maybe even use a different word than participation, mm-hmm. a lot of people, it's and surveillance, it's pretty complex, I think.
It's quite an interesting equation. On the one side, we have the example we talked about from TikTok, right? So this is a lot of kind of young teens using a technology or an algorithm that we could say is itself surveillance, right? It organizes a lot of information flows and understanding how to talk back to it using a lot of like community organizing. And I really love this example. A lot of the younger teens that like this Korean boy band. And whenever there is some sort of discussion that is full of misinformation, that is politically unaligned with them, they would kind of pollute or bombard the algorithm or certain hashtags with information from this band, right? So this is really, I feel, is an example of a technologically aware, a very participatory act of counter-surveillance. I think maybe the reframing that we need, and based on the roles that we talked about, is that all of this is an exercise in community building.
Yeah.
So a community has people with different roles engaging in maybe some sort of collateral action on different levels. And I don't know, maybe this is the right takeaway from the conversation. Yeah, maybe it's not.
I do think that there's an interesting thing there, because when you look at participation in the old days, it's more like a collective action. So it was top down, but mobilizing a big group is pretty difficult. And nowadays you could say it's in a way collective, but it's more or less connected action. So you could also have a big voice without even getting out of your seat. When you find the right connections, maybe even on different parts of the spectrum, left or right, you could still find common ground. And I think when it comes to inverse surveillance, it should also lead to more common ground instead of leading to more polarization. When it comes down to being human and our human values, a lot of times we have the same values. I mean, left or right, we all want a safer world. I mean, me and my children or the children of my children should grow up in a safe place. I mean, everyone has the same feeling about that. The way we should create that, okay, we have a different conversation. But I guess if we focus more on our common ground and our common values instead of polarizing and holding on to this point of view and never let go, then inverse surveillance isn't really helping us. But I do think that this, like this connected action, and we find communities and we can strengthen each other. And then obviously we don't need to look at governments or businesses as our enemies, because then the same thing happens again. But in a way, we looking at it as a common goal.
I really like this idea of networked action, like that you mentioned. Right. So it's democracy alone is not enough. So I think we talk about democratizing surveillance, but it seems to me from the conversation that that alone is not enough. We need some sort of value driven design, community first design principles whenever we're designing any system, right? That has bi-directional data flows. So because you are also a designer, because you thought about ethical design of systems, let's say I am kind of drafting a platform or drafting another configuration for inverse surveillance. What are some design principles that you would advise me to adopt?
First thing that comes in my mind, and a lot of people's minds maybe, but is don't think for the people, but ask the people. So it doesn't really happen that often that people are really involved. And I'm not just talking about people who are the decision makers. And I'm not just talking about the people who already want to participate and who are already politically involved, but also people who are like, I don't give a shit about politics. Politicians are not for me. I don't vote. I don't care. Those are the people who I want to talk in order to make these kinds of systems. And also the people who are like, I'm not a digital native. I don't know how to bank online. I want to talk to those people who are like, I have no clue. So talk to the people. Yeah, maybe it's too easy, but I think that's the first design principle that I should use.
No, but it makes sense, because we mentioned earlier, every context, every type of person, they have different needs. Right? Can't measure everyone with the same stick. I don't know if this is saying, but no, it really makes sense. And now I imagine, like we mentioned in the beginning, it's not one future that is inverse surveillance. It's multiple futures or multiple worlds for different contexts.
Exactly. The needs of universes.
Oh yeah, 100%. Because the needs of a teen on TikTok in terms of being watched is different than a need from a highly involved citizen and their government, for example, right? So yeah, it seems to me that thinking about the designs of these systems, having a really truly participatory framework for thinking about surveillance is really the first step. I would like to kind of open the floor for concluding remarks. We're going towards the end. We've talked about a lot, but I'm not sure if Stefan, you have something to add or ask in conclusion.
Well, I want to reflect on the, I think, lessons that Rudy presented us, and also that can help us towards our hackathon. So I think so far I've drawn three lessons from our conversation. The first is Rudy injected the word participation into our discussion, and he presented the pyramid. And I think so far we've been looking at inverse surveillance mostly from the passive observer side. So collecting data and making a decision about it, which is like the bottom of the pyramid. And I think what Rudy showed is that it's not just about these passive roles. It can also be more active, and it can be, you know, sort of the top part of the pyramid is through sort of radical digital activism. And so I think we should expand our idea of what inverse surveillance could be also to this top part. The second lesson I draw from it is that it's not just about how do we get people involved in the decision-making processes that we have. It's also bottom-up. How do we empower communities that are already networked, and that are, how do we mobilize them and give them impact so that they can actually use this information gathering capabilities that they have in order to make better informed decisions or different types of decisions. The third lesson that can be drawn from this that would also be, I think, very helpful for those who participate in our hackathon is involve people. So definitely any prototype or pilot project that is going to be built, you should talk to people. And if I hear really correctly, talk to the people who might be the least favorable for your project, who are most difficult to reach. Because if you're able to reach those people and make them enthusiastic about your project, then you have everybody on board. So I think it's a very useful and very concrete challenge that really poses to the participants of our hackathon.
Definitely. Don't think for someone, think with someone. And I think in the beginning, I talked about how inverse surveillance has been somewhat of an abstract concept. And I think we've employed a lot of nuance to bring it down, especially with Rudy's comments on democratization, participation, on not needing 100% transparency because there is a performative aspect, on kind of modes of participation, community building, about the iterative design or the iterative process of finding responsibility in such a system. So I think that's all really, really valuable. I really like to thank you a lot, Rudy, for your generosity and expertise. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you too.
I would also love to thank Stefan for the input and also the direction you're able to give the conversation. And I would love to thank Sabine behind the scenes as well for making all of this possible. So thank you all so much. And hope to talk with you again soon.
Yes, let's.
For more information, links and show notes, please visit futurebased.org.